Therefore, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. St. Paul, Acts chapter 26, verse 19. A fascinating study for the student of the Bible is to compare the different narratives of St. Paul's conversion. It is told four times in the New Testament, thrice in the book of Acts, and once in the Apostle's letter to the Galatians. In the verse I've cited above from St. Paul, he describes his experience to King Agrippa and that he was not disobedient to that which God revealed to him. He also recalls the words the risen Lord used to commission him, including the call to preach the gospel to the Gentiles. Even earlier in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul tells a hostile Jewish crowd that as he was praying in the temple in Jerusalem, he fell into a trance and saw Jesus saying to him, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." Even earlier in Acts chapter 9, Ananias, a Jewish lay leader, is instructed by the Lord to go pray for Paul, who is in prayer, fasting on a street called Straight. When Ananias hesitates because of Paul's reputation of persecuting Christians, God tells him, "Go, for he," that is Paul, "is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name." There is no need to see a conflict in these accounts. Anyone who has tried to tell the intricacies of his or her conversion or witness to God's miraculous intervention will recognize just how much one must leave out or at least merge for the sake of the audience. Whichever dimension of the heavenly vision the apostle was referring to when he spoke before King Agrippa, it is clear that the call to be an apostle to the Gentiles was for Paul his great mission. This was the heavenly vision to which he was not disobedient. Indeed, it was that for which Christ took hold of him. As I've tried to be faithful to the call given to me as your bishop some 8 years ago and seek to recognize the path that this diocese has traveled down through the years as we've stood on past generations' faithfulness and the leadership of bishops such as Bishop Fitz Allison and Bishop Ed Salmon, this statement of the apostle, "Therefore, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision," has come often to my mind. My first convention as your bishop, I said, we cannot sit on the sidelines and wait for things to unfold, leaving others to shape the future in which we shall live. We must be among those who shape the future. Thus, I am increasingly convinced that God has called us to help shape the future of Anglicanism in the 21st century through mutually enriching missional relationships with dioceses and provinces of the Anglican Communion and through modeling a responsible autonomy and interprovincial accountability for the sake of Jesus Christ, his kingdom, and his church. You know it as the T-shirt version, "We shall make biblical Anglicans for a global age." The T-shirt version has stuck. The other has faded into the past. But I am more convinced now than ever, however inadequately we may have received, embodied it, and conveyed it, that this is a vision from the Lord for this diocese of South Carolina at this time. I've also come to accept that what it takes a year or two for a new rector to establish in a parish takes 5 years for a bishop to achieve in a diocese. It is only in recent years that I've heard rectors reciting this statement in a way that rolls naturally off of their tongue. I mean, the way it was said to begin with 3 or 4 years ago was sad indeed. It was hardly recognizable. But now, even the farthest reaching parish has a rector that can say, "We're making biblical Anglicans for a global age." What does that mean? Two things. To help every congregation to engage every generation with the good news of Jesus Christ, and to help shape emerging Anglicanism in the 21st century. Let me begin with the first rail of making biblical Anglicans for a global age. We have doggedly kept on this path, this track we're on, this railroad track of two rails. The one trail has a local focus, the other a more global one. As Jacques Ellul put it years ago, we need to think globally and act locally. So let me highlight the first rail first. Every congregation engaging every generation with the good news of Jesus Christ. For years, the Reverend Craig Barrett challenged me at Dean's meetings that we needed to reshape our diocesan conventions. Frankly, I never took this as personal criticism, for the diocesan staff and I were just following the well-trod precedent from the past. An opening Eucharist, some gathering on Friday evening, followed by the business convention on Saturday. Dean Barrett's mantra, however, was, why don't we focus on ministry more than canonical matters? Well, it was a good question and a worthy challenge. Finally, at the diocesan convention in Florence in 2013, the diocesan staff and I decided to respond to his entreaties. Admittedly, our venture was hardly a heavy wager of resources, but it was something, and it was a modest success. So in 2014 and again in 2015, we added even more workshops. This year was perhaps still not everything Craig would like. Where are you, Craig? I did see you there, though. It may not be everything he would like, but it is clearly the most expansive pre-convention event we've launched. We had major presentation on Friday morning on Christian grandparents reaching their grandchildren for Jesus Christ, a full menu of ministry workshops in the afternoon. Many of the offerings were given by clergy and lay leaders from within our diocese. Perhaps it's time to stop calling it pre-convention and make it officially part of the convention. I think that would even meet Craig's approval. Thank you, Craig. Some of the best ideas come from people out in the battlefield saying what they need in order to do their ministry more effectively. You'll be hearing from Dave Wright, our diocesan coordinator of youth ministry, and Peter Rothermel, coordinator of faith formation, later today, but about many ministries in the diocese, but I want to highlight a few new developments. The first is we have a coordinator now of men's ministry in the Diocese of South Carolina. Jay Krause is a layman from Florida. He and his wife have moved here to Charleston. Jay has set up office in an empty room on the second floor of the diocesan house. While receiving no stipend from the diocese, he nevertheless freely offers his experience and expertise in developing men's ministry in a local congregation. His book, Men and the Church, is an excellent resource for priests and laymen who want to see a growing ministry to men in their congregations. I commend him and his ministry. Call him. He'll be glad to help. I see him back there recording something. Please stand, Jay. Welcome to the diocese, and thank you for your ministry. With the break from the Episcopal Church in November of 2012, there was an obvious need to redesign women's ministry on a diocesan level. The ECW was an entity of the past, but what should we replace it with? While several of our congregations had vital and active women's ministries, They were unrelated to the Episcopal ECW, the Episcopal Church women. Particularly, they were unrelated in large places like Holy Cross Sullivan's Island, Trinity Myrtle Beach, and St. Paul's Somerville. They were dynamic ministries carried on within the parish. So what should the future look like? While the Diocesan Women's Ministry, which is their new name, are still in restructuring process, having experienced a real loss with the death of their chaplain, the Reverend Martha Horn, they nevertheless are pressing on, charting a way forward in this new season, seeking to take the best from the past while striving to adapt to a very different world of today. I want to show a new video they have produced for an upcoming event that they have planned at Holy Trinity Windermere in April.
Hello, I'm Allison Lawrence, and this is my daughter, Chelsea Hamshaw. I was praying, and it came to me that we needed to talk about going deeper in the faith. Going deeper with the idea that someone, in particular our children, might be paying attention to us.
Yeah, so we're going to be looking at what it means to go deeper in the faith, that is, deeper into Scripture, which leads us deeper to the cross of Christ.
Yes.
And deeper into relationships with one another.
We are meeting at Holy Trinity Windermere on April 30th, beginning at 10 o'clock. Lunch is included. Please join us.
Thank you, Diocesan Women's Ministry. Do you know that 7 out of 10 adults in America consider themselves deeply spiritual? 4 out of 5 say their religious faith is very important to them. Yet that doesn't mean they attend church or know how their faith fits into their lives, their work, their family relationships, their daily routines, or the problems of their finances. They don't know how to relate it to their health, their lifestyle, their future. Let alone do they know how to nurture the life with God or grow as followers of Jesus Christ. They don't know how to live abundantly, meaningfully, and enjoyable lives. With God, for God, in God. One of the most effective ways of engaging the new generations of people with the good news of Jesus Christ is through church plants. Studies have shown over and over again to plant a church or a satellite congregation is sometimes one of the best ways to reach them. And I believe a new day of church planting has got to begin in the Diocese of South Carolina. How, though, should we carry this ministry out? Should church plants be the work of the diocesan staff and the committee of diocesan council? Or should this be done by existing parishes working in step with the diocesan leadership? I tend to favor the second of these methods, but if our existing congregations do not see the need for or believe they have the resources to plant a new congregation, what then? I was prayerfully grappling with this question last week, planning to raise the question at this convention, when I received an email from the Reverend Gary Beeson, one of our new church planters. And as you know, St. Timothy's Church in Cane Bay was just received as a new mission of this convention. And it is a joint venture between St. Paul's Somerville and the Diocese of South Carolina. St. Paul's has supplied a bevy of members with which to launch the church, and the diocese some modest funds. Well, as I was praying what I would say, Gary sent an email. I mean, I was literally in prayer for about 30 minutes when the email dinged. And I opened it up and read it. I thought, is that not serendipitous? Is that not how God works? Good morning, Bishop Mark and Father Chuck. I met with Mr. Barry Jurz, Berkeley County Economic Development Director, this morning at his office and got a clearer picture of what this county is growing towards in terms of industrial and commercial development, which ultimately means new people moving here to fill the jobs. It was an exciting meeting, and I wished both of you could have been there to hear all of his projections. I'm writing to express a desire to be a part of some diocesan strategy of church growth that seeks to do what we did in business, which was open our locations where the populations were that we sought to serve. The good news about church planting is that everyone is our population. So we just need to go where the people are, and after my meeting with Mr. Jurz, I am more convinced than ever that the people are coming here. The transportation system and infrastructure alone is poised to support industry and commercial development, the likes of which we have never seen before in this area. Talk to Chuck Owens. You'll hear that in Jasper County, right across from the Savannah River, is all a huge population of people moving in, job opportunities, growth everywhere. Who's going to seize the day? So why did Gary reference Chuck Owens? Well, he's the chairman of the Congregational Development Committee. It is a committee of diocesan council. As the rector of the Cross Bluffton, he is an ideal person to chair this committee. Each year I attend the Cross's annual parish meeting, and every year Chuck stands right here on this platform and addresses 300 or so parishioners of the Cross Bluffton and gives them a charge of vision for the future. Every year, without fail, it's inspiring. Every year, it tells the story of growth. Between their two campuses, their average Sunday attendance is 1,220 people. They added this past year 274 new members to the parish, 83 men, 110 women, and 81 children. He spoke of several new initiatives planned for the future. It grips the people. They feel the vision. They feel the passion. And they lean into it with their energy, their hearts, their lives, and their money. Chuck said all rectors fit into one of three categories: undertakers, caretakers, risk takers. Father Chuck is a risk taker. Both the Church of the Cross and the Diocese of South Carolina have benefited from Father Chuck and his vision. We are in the very place he once had a vision for. It was just a dream, but a dream that was shared. A dream shared, a dream embraced, becomes a dream realized. Father Chuck, Gary, and I, and perhaps a few others, will meet this spring to plan strategically for the growth burgeoning around Charleston and elsewhere along the coast of South Carolina. There's probably very few gatherings more important than what comes out of that and where we go with that as a diocese. One final venture to help every congregation engage every generation with the gospel of Jesus Christ. For some time now, I have thought that we needed a canon missioner for the diocese. The workload for Canon Lewis and for the rest of the diocesan staff, including myself, means that many opportunities for growing or remissioning our existing congregations go unseized. Recently, I met with the rector and vestry of All Saints Florence. This is a congregation that John Burwell and Holy Cross Sullivan's Island breathed new life into some years ago. Now, under the leadership of Father Carl Burns, it continues to grow. But the growth barriers for a congregation transitioning from a collie-sized church to a garden-sized church are many. Some of you may say, Bishop, what is a collie-sized church? Well, it has an average Sunday attendance of between 50 and 100 people, and it often stabilizes at 70. A garden has an average Sunday attendance of between 100 and 175, and it stabilizes at 120, often with 35 to 40 members at the 8 o'clock service, which is a cat congregation, and 70 to 80 at 10 o'clock, which is a collie-sized congregation, and together they make up a garden, and you know what cats and collies do in a garden. But as a church goes from the collie size to the garden size, it puts demands upon the rector and demands upon the congregation, and both have to recognize a new season is upon them, or they will stay at the collie-sized congregation till death does them part, they become a cat, and then they go the way of all flesh. Even though it's hard to kill a cat, they have 9 lives. Well, anyway, it's one thing for a bishop to spend an afternoon with a vestry and priest to address these issues, but think how much better to have an experienced canon missioner coming alongside such congregations on a monthly basis. I'm exploring alternative funding to bring such a person on the diocesan staff, confident that if we can bring the right person on with non-budgeted money for a year or two, the position will soon pay for itself from the growth of our congregations. The right person is the key. Now I can hear Saint Swithin's in the Swamp saying to me at this point, Bishop, do you really think that we can engage every generation in this congregation? And my answer to the 25 parishioners is no, I don't believe you can engage every generation. But you can engage one generation with the good news of Jesus Christ, and if you don't, you will not be around for the next generation. Well, let's move to the second rail of the vision of making biblical Anglicans for a global age, shaping emerging Anglicanism in the 21st century. Begin with a brief look backwards. A few years ago, we developed the Anglican Communion Development Committee. It has been a key vehicle through which we have formed missional relationships with dioceses and provinces within the Anglican Communion. This committee, under the leadership of the Reverend Bob Lawrence and Dr. Kendall Harmon, has helped in linking us in the larger Anglican world, whether with Global South Primate Steering Committee, the GAFCON Primates, Anglican Relief and Development, or the many provinces and bishops and dioceses around the world. It has also played a strategic role in helping many of our parishes establish missional relationships with dioceses around the Anglican Communion. While some of our parishes, such as Old St. Andrews, continue a meaningful relationship with the Dominican Republic, increasingly, many have responded to my call to engage in active ministry with those provinces and dioceses that have stood with us in our time of need. Our Savior John's Island has engaged in several missions with the Diocese of Egypt, North Africa, and the Horn of Africa. St. John's John's Island has entered a partnership with Northern Uganda. Christ Church Mount Pleasant and St. Paul's Somerville have relationships with Marsabit, Kenya. Just this past Saturday, I saw the rector of Christ Church Mount Pleasant come in second place in his age category in the 5K tree run. Well done. He dropped a place from last year, but he'll get it back next year. The bishop also ran, though he hadn't been running in a couple of months. He got second place in his category. So we're doing our part for building tree churches in Marsabit, Kenya. God bless you all for that. The Cross here in Bluffton has relationships with the Diocese of Kilmore, Elphin, and Ardaw, and the Diocese of Derry in Ireland. They bring Irish leaders here for a week of study, learning, fellowship, and they send people there to share the ways of growth that they have learned. St. Luke's with Dar es Salaam in Tanzania has had a very long and fruitful, impacting relationship. Others I haven't time to mention. Thank you for establishing these relationships. And if your congregation hasn't yet found a diocese with which to network in missional relationships, the New Wineskins Conference is this April 7th through 10th. After that conference is over, there will be bishops and leaders from around the Anglican Communion flooding into the Diocese of South Carolina, looking for a place to land and looking for a partner to partner with them in spreading the kingdom of Jesus Christ. Mere Anglicanism. I was walking out of the wonderful worship service last night, some 300 or 400 people in a whoosh type service. You know, that's what often the seeker is looking for, a whoosh experience. Whoosh, the power, the energy, the excitement. And I was walking, as I was walking out, one of the senior wardens, or previous senior wardens of one of our churches in the greater Charleston area said, "Wow, wasn't that a great service?" I said, "It was a terrific service." I said, "By the way, have you been to the Mere Anglican Conference worship service?" I said, "What's that?" I said, "Mere Anglicanism? You don't know what that is?" "No." "Do you know that every year 800 to 900 Anglicans from around the world flood in to the Cathedral of St. Luke and St. Paul, and a dynamic worship service like the one you experienced tonight happens right there in your hometown?" "No, I didn't know about it." I said, "Does your priest tell you about it?" "No." I said, "You just made my bishop's address." How can you have the penultimate or perhaps the ultimate Anglican conference every year in Charleston and you not know about it and your priest doesn't tell your parishioners about it? For many years, this has been an important ministry within the diocese. It was first initiated by Bishop Allison and Dean McKeachy. In recent years, it's come under the aegis of the Reverend Jeffrey Miller and St. Helena's Buford, and it has become the foremost conference for emerging Anglicanism in this century, engaging the great issues of the day, science and faith, one year, secularism and Christianity, the cross and crescent, a Christian perspective on Islam, this last January. 800 or 900 people from across the United States and the United Kingdom coming here to participate. During last year's conference, Archbishop Munir Anis takes me aside. He comes up to me and says, "This diocese of South Carolina, this small diocese of South Carolina, is probably doing more than any diocese in the world to help shape Anglicanism today. We've not been disobedient to the heavenly vision." One of the ways to help shape Anglicanism in the 21st century is to shape the leaders of the future. Success so often rises or falls on leadership. Let me share with you two leadership initiatives we just launched and two others scheduled to begin this year. Next Level Leadership Initiative was launched just this last year. I've spoken for years at previous diocese conventions that I hope to begin post-ordination training program for the newly ordained clergy fresh out of seminary. Finally, during a meeting last year with Father Shea Gilliard, my vision for the project found the right leader of the project. However, Father Shea, coming from a different generation than I, suggested another name than post-ordination training or port. Some people call it potty training. So the Next Level Leadership Initiative was born. He and I have worked together to host phases 1 and 2 last year, and we have phase 3 already scheduled at St. Christopher later this spring. Seasoned clergy of the diocese have been teachers and consultant for these gatherings. Shea's leadership in this has been essential for its success, and I thank you, Shea, for stepping forward and saying, "Here am I, send me." God bless you for that. Speaking of vision, needing to find the right leader, the Anglican Leadership Institute is a perfect illustration of this axiom. In my bishop's address 2 years ago, I dared to mention a new dream for how the diocese could more richly fulfill our vision of making biblical Anglicans for a global age and help shape Anglicanism in the 21st century. I said, "It is for now an embryonic dream, and I have debated with myself if I should even share it with you, but let me give you a glimpse of something I've had only a glimpse of. What if we establish in this diocese an institute to bring emerging Anglican leaders from across the world for 4 to 6 weeks of residential study, prayer, renewal, reflection, with seasoned leaders and scholars? Imagine what building relationships of gospel affection and missionary vision for reaching the secular and the religious cultures of the 21st century might mean for those who labor in demanding vineyards. Imagine what it could mean for emerging Anglican leaders to come here from various parts of the communion for a season of study, renewal, and refreshment, and to have our clergy study and pray alongside them under such scholars as Michael Nazarelli and many others. Imagine what a remarkable vision and perspective these young leaders and our own priests might be given. This would be designed for those in mid-strive who have been ministering for 10, 15, or perhaps even 20 years, who would be strengthened by such a time of prayer, study, and visioning with other leaders, and deepen their confidence in the gospel." Well, under the leadership of the Reverend Dr. Peter Moore and an outstanding board of directors and a bevy of volunteers, many of whom are members of St. Michael's Church in Charleston, and through the gifts of a generous benefactor, the dream shared in 2014 became a reality this January. Let me share a brief video made during this first year's session.
The Anglican Communion is the third largest Christian body in the world. The major growth in the last 25 or 35 years is in the Global South, in Africa, in Southeast Asia, somewhat in South America. Anglican Leadership Institute was created in 2015 out of a vision of our Bishop Mark Lawrence here in South Carolina, who thought, "We have so many resources here. What if we offered those resources to our brothers and sisters in the Global South?"
We would like to graduate 30 strong candidates every year from nations around the world who would be able to help grow the church faster and better than is happening today, bring more people to Christ.
Where I'm coming from, we need good leaders who are positive in their thinking, who are humble in their exercising of their powers. Because I'm coming from a place that a leader could be very powerful in Nigeria, very, very powerful. And I've come here, I've seen leaders. I interacted with Bishop Mark Lawrence, and he's a great man. A bunch of humility I saw in him. You now know that he's the Bishop of South Carolina. My coming here, all paid by the Institute. Our accommodation, feeding here, all paid by the Institute. It was a blessing that forever we live to remember, because if I were to pay I couldn't have afforded to even pay for one-way ticket. It's as a result of the generosity of people of South Carolina. So many people gave this money.
We all have this common identity in Jesus Christ. Part of the vision is that after a month together here, they will go back to their several countries, knowing each other, staying in touch with each other, and meeting each other at future conferences and gatherings, and they will have a bond.
We have built a wonderful and unique relationship in the Anglican Church of the World, and this is very important. Even after we finish this course, this relationship will continue.
Leadership Institute is a great place. I go back home with a prayer that it must continue, because I see this as a place whereby leaders are trained for a better church of today and tomorrow.
I think we have a shot here at making a great impact on the church and potentially the world. It's our obligation to make the most of that shot.
To me, the future of the church depends on this Leadership Institute. I can see this was really a vision from God.
You priests who came and shared a day at this gathering, thank you for that ministry. Lay people that might be here who were part of that, thank you for that. It could not have happened without you. Thank you for the congregations who welcomed some of these ALI fellows to your worship services on Sunday and shared time with them. They are the leaders of the Anglican Communion in the future. Most are already bishops. Some may soon be bishops. Some are in charge of seminaries in places like Uganda. Some will become archbishops. You touched tomorrow, today, by your time, your gifts, your love, and your passion. We've not been disobedient to the heavenly vision. Now, briefly, two new leadership initiatives which I pray will be birthed during this next year. The first is clergy continuing education. I've talked over the years about the need to financially assist our clergy to take time for continuing education. I benefited from a diocesan fund and a clergy continuing education committee when I served as a priest in the Diocese of Pittsburgh under Bishop Hathaway. But I noticed when I came to South Carolina that there was no such fund and no such committee. I've mentioned it in addresses as well as at clergy conferences, but it's just remained something to be done when all else was finished. And it was never finished. A bishop's work's like a housewife's work. It's never finished. But just recently, Bishop Allison came to my rescue. He has long been an advocate for continuing education for the clergy. He and several priests of the diocese, including the Reverend Dr. Donnie McDaniel, have decided to wait no longer. Thank God. You know, it's my idea to come up with ideas as theirs to do it. That's how I see it. The full shape of this new committee and its charge is still developing. But God willing, the first steps will be taken this year. So get with it, clergy. Get ready. God willing, we'll have a means to help you stay healthy. Mid-vocation rectors is the next step. The renowned historian and biographer David McCullough recently presented a lecture at the Citadel. He shared several profound lessons he learned through his study of great leaders, which I hastily wrote down on a scrap of paper I found in my suit pocket. One of these was this. One of the first lessons of history is you can't accomplish anything great alone. Another statement was, I've never met a leader who was not a reader. Well, several of our senior rectors have retired or are preparing to do so. So I ask myself, who will be the leaders of the next chapter of our diocesan life? And for that matter, who will be the leaders in emerging Anglicanism in North America? Far too often, senior leaders are so busy doing tasks that they do not sufficiently invest in growing the younger leaders who will succeed them. That is the case in many business corporations. It is definitely the case in the church that senior leaders do not spend enough time asking themselves, who will be taking over? Frankly, I have a growing passion to spend more time with those rectors who are in mid-career. I've neglected some of you because I spend my time with squeaking wheels. And those who are the strong get whatever's left over. Well, no more. If I have to ignore the squeaky wheel and say, face your own problems, okay. But I want to spend my time that I have as your bishop, whatever time that is, pouring myself into those who will be the leaders of the future. And how do I know who they are? They are the leaders now. They're in mid-career. What form this will take, I do not yet know, but I mention it here so that both you and I can hold me responsible for doing it. That's one thing I've learned. I've got to say it out loud to the congregation or the diocese so that then I feel the pressure to get it done. A couple of years ago, I was in downtown Disney with my family. The park was doing some construction and had plywood blocking the work area, but they did not waste the space. They had sayings of Walt Disney placarded on these barricades. I took photos of the sayings. One fits well with my new commitment to mid-vocation rectors. The way to quit... Oh, it's right up here. The way to get started is to quit talking and begin doing. Another one he had was... Get a good idea, stay with it, dog it and work at it until it's done and done right. Well, I'm going to take a page out of the Magic Kingdom for the Great Kingdom of God and get going. I'm almost finished, so hold on with me if you can just a little bit longer. One final thing for this rail of helping to shape tomorrow's Anglicanism, although it could fit under every congregation engaging every generation. Later in this convention, you will hear from the Task Force on Provincial Affiliation. They are going to look at flipping the script. Whenever we have talked about affiliating with the Anglican Church in North America, we've always focused on their problems, overlapping jurisdictions, various DNAs that came together. Questions of ordination. We've always looked at the problems. Well, it's time to flip the script and ask, what are the possibilities? The task force will share many of these. You got a glimpse of it just last night from Bishop Thad Barnum, who is passionate about clergy health, clergy care, clergy well-being. They know a lot about planting churches. They've been at it for a while. They're pretty good at reaching the millennial generation. I was at one of their churches up in Grove City, Pennsylvania. They meet in an ice cream parlor. They had 150 people there in the ice cream parlor. 100 of them were college students coming to Anglicanism and feeling the need for something with some depth, but authenticity and some passion. They know a little bit about the world we don't know enough about. More importantly, I believe this affiliation will unleash new opportunities for our younger clergy to be shaped and to shape what God is doing in North America. And it will help all of us to a greater focus beyond ourselves, working alongside our brothers and sisters in Christ. I'll share more of these thoughts in the future at deanery convocations, but it's time we engage with this question specifically, directly, in this year to come. Well, I've shared a vision for the future, and I can hear someone thinking to herself, Bishop, there's a lot to take in here, given the fact that we've been running against the wind now for some time. Well, yes, it is a lot to take in, but as I noted earlier, I just heard David McCullough, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of leaders, give a lecture at the Citadel. He spoke about some of the lessons he learned from writing his recent book on the Wright brothers. You know, they cracked the code of flight by scientific study and by observing birds. You know what they discovered? If you want to fly, you don't want the wind at your back. You want it in your face. No bird, he said, ever soared in a calm. And I learned some years ago, an eagle doesn't roost in a sparrow's nest. So, following what the Apostle Paul has said, I, on my part, therefore, am so running as one not distracted from keeping an eye clearly on the goal. Yesterday, I got a text message that I'll end with. Well, actually, it was an email from Father Greg Snyder, who has the horrible job of having to write resolutions based on this convention address. This is what he wrote. And I'll conclude with this. Dear Bishop, I need to tell you that my dad was an air traffic controller aboard the aircraft carrier USS Independence during the Vietnam War. He said, when they were ready to engage the enemy, the captain of the ship would say, "Let's put it into the wind." He meant, let's align the carrier so that all the flight takeoffs would be directly into the wind to create greater lift for the air to the wind. So I say about the Diocese of South Carolina, let's put her into the wind.